This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
From our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
For months, Russia has been menacing Europe. Well, this week they issued a threat and a stunning set of demands really aimed at destroying NATO. For this remarkable story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this just came in from Russia's deputy foreign minister. Today he gave a press conference and released a couple of draft treaties with Russia's demands. So they've had all of these troops menacing Ukraine. They've been cutting off Europe's oil and gas. They've been threatening trouble in the Balkans. We've been talking about all of these things on this show. And we've kind of been saying, well, what's the end game here? What is Russia trying to accomplish? And I think we might have just found out in the last hour or two. They want Eastern Europe divided between the two of them, basically. I mean, this is kind of, it's not a return to the Cold War and the Iron Curtain and the Warsaw Pact, but it is very much a step in that direction. So what they're demanding is that Russia be given a say in the fate of Eastern Europe, basically. All these post-Soviet states that maybe were part of the USSR or Russia kind of controlled as part of the Warsaw Pact, they want some level of control again. So some of the points of this draft treaty would ban both Russia and the US from deploying intermediate range missiles within reach of each other's territory. America would promise not to open military bases in any post-Soviet countries. America would promise not to deploy nuclear weapons abroad, or both sides would, but America's the only one that has really done this. And so that would mean all of America's nuclear weapons that they've got stationed and lent to European countries would have to come home. Perhaps the biggest ones come from a draft multilateral agreement with NATO. And NATO would agree not to expand further east. Ukraine would be specifically excluded from NATO membership. They would promise never to allow Ukraine to become a NATO member. They will not deploy any more forces or arms outside the border of its membership as of May 1997. So what that means is no NATO troops, no NATO forces traveling into the Balkans, traveling into Poland, traveling into Hungary, the Czech Republic, all of Eastern Europe, all of these former Warsaw Pact countries would be off limits. And then you know, neither side would be able to carry out military drills in Eastern Europe without permission of the other country. So NATO would need Russia's permission if they want to carry out military drills in Eastern Europe or in the Caucasus. And I think the effect of these demands, if they were agreed to, is even bigger than they appear when you just itemize them like that, because of the principles involved. The cumulative effect of agreeing to all of this is for Europe and for NATO and for the United States to cross a line that they have consistently refused to cross since the end of the Cold War, which is to say, Russia, you get a say in the fate of countries beyond your border. They have time and time again refused to do that. Ukraine and some of these other countries would become a type of second-class state, unable to move away from Russia without Russia's permission, which they're never getting. Like I said, it wouldn't create the Warsaw Pact overnight. It would be a step in the direction of the Warsaw Pact. And really, I think it would be an end to NATO as the defense for Eastern Europe. Because it would be if America were to agree to something like this, it would be a very public declaration from the United States that says to Poland and these other countries, if push comes to shove, we're prepared to throw you under the bus. And we will give in to Russia when it comes to your security. So if something like this was signed, that would completely undermine the foundations for the defense of the Balkan states, for Poland. It would completely change their relationship with the United States, their relationship with Europe. So Vladimir Putin is making some pretty revolutionary demands here.
It will be very interesting to see how the United States and NATO nations respond to this set of demands. But you do have to hand it to Russia in a sense. This is something when you just look back on what it has been doing and you look at the troop deployments on the Ukrainian border, they're just Russian troops all over the place and prepared to move in. They've been positioning themselves to be able to have considerable leverage at a moment like this. It's interesting, too, that this is taking place just after the completion of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, another very strong leverage that they have against European nations. Russia knows what it's doing. Vladimir Putin is a very shrewd operator.
Yes, it is really interesting. I mean, that going to that first point about the troop station there, they have said that if their demands aren't met, that they will be some, they said they promised some kind of military intervention. They said it would be a kind of like a Cuban Missile Crisis type of event that that they would follow up on. And you know, you look at all of their troops that are over there, there's a very heavily implied threat in everything that they're doing. But yeah, I do think that this is fascinating that this comes out this right after the Nord Stream 2 pipeline has finished. And we've been saying for years, watch this relationship between Germany and Russia. This is a critical relationship. The two have worked together in the past. They have divided Europe between the two of them together in the past. You know, that's very famous in the run-up to World War II, but that is definitely not even the only time that they have done that. We've looked at the way that Germany has responded to a crisis in Ukraine, crisis to Georgia, and says it's quite likely they've had some kind of agreement already, especially when you look at this pipeline that they've been giving. This pipeline cements Russia's control over Eastern Europe because it allows Russia to cut off gas to Eastern European countries in the middle of winter, hold them to ransom, while continuing to supply their more lucrative customers in Western Europe via Germany. So you look at all of that, and it really does look like they've done a deal, even just over Ukraine. Just this week, Ukraine has been complaining that Germany isn't doing more to help them. And then, in fact, that Germany is sitting there within NATO, blocking NATO from selling more weapons to Ukraine, making Ukraine's position more difficult. So, back in 2008, Mr. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, he said, Did you know that Germany and Russia have probably already dealt with their most urgent differences? And so then you see this deal come out, and he said, I believe that Germany's leaders may have already agreed to a deal with Russia, a modern Hitler-Stalin pact where Germany and Russia divide countries and assets between themselves. You know, Nord Stream 2 is finished. Russia comes out with this program. And we'll have to see how this plays out, but that would be, I think, the effect of these demands would be to divide Europe between Russia and Germany. It would completely break the United States as being the foundation for Europe's defense. Poland wouldn't be able to look to NATO for security anymore. They'd have to look to Germany. And I'm not proficient enough in international law to get into the minutiae of the treaties, but I would imagine that these treaties, though they would prohibit German forces moving into Poland under the NATO umbrella, they would be allowed to under the European Union flag. And so it would push all of these kind of things that Poland does whenever they're nervous, where they want more troops to come and help defend them and this kind of thing. They would have to start doing that under the EU umbrella rather than the NATO umbrella if this were agreed to. So, yeah, it would have the effect of dividing Europe, or at least beginning that division between Europe and Germany. Sorry, between Russia and Germany.
I think, too, about just how NATO has already been in an existential crisis with the United States, its role in the world changing so dramatically, really over the past decade. The terms under which the United States entered into that alliance are just so different. And if NATO had any power to be able to stop Russia, it seems like Russia is really taking advantage of this moment to kind of put the nail in the coffin on this alliance. Jeremiah, looking at this from Russia's perspective, obviously it looks at Eastern Europe as very vital to its own interests, Ukraine in particular. How do you view this from its perspective and from the standpoint of Bible prophecy?
Yeah, well, it's clear that from Russia's perspective, Ukraine and so much of Eastern Europe, it's really an existential threat for the Russians to see NATO expand into that area. And several previous U.S. presidents specifically promised that NATO would not expand into Ukraine and several of the other areas that were former Soviet space. But I think from a standpoint of Bible prophecy, the most interesting thing happening here is probably what's happening with Eastern Europeans. The Eastern European voices who are speaking up about this, there's just been a whole chorus of them this week. One particularly loud one was from Estonia's Prime Minister, Kaja Kallas. She said, quote, "Estonians are always worried about our big neighbor. We clearly see Crimea. We see Donbass. We see Georgia. Russia has made the steps that are hurting different countries, and therefore, we should all be worried." So, you know, this shows the effect that this is having on Eastern Europeans. A great number of Eastern Europeans see what Russia has done in Ukraine and in Georgia, and they know that it's no bluff, and they have good reason to think that their own countries could be next. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has discussed how this fear will be a major factor that prompts the Europeans to unify their countries into a united military and political bloc. It was shortly after Russia had annexed Crimea that he wrote, quote, "We've been prophesying for around 70 years that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower. This prophecy is directly related to the Crimean crisis. The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of a European empire. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy." End quote. So, you know, the Europeans are fearful of Russia amassing troops and making all these demands on NATO that we just heard about there. And as the Estonian prime minister said, Europeans are deeply worried about all of that. And they see that the best way to stand up to the threat is to unify European nations together. So it's easy to see, I think, how, just as Mr. Fleury wrote, how this will play a pivotal role in the unification of Europe that we've been expecting.
Yeah, and it is notable that it's outside of the NATO umbrella, that it's basically the pressure on NATO is forcing Europeans to look to themselves, within themselves, to have their own independent European military to be able to address such threats, which is something that we have been expecting based on Bible prophecy for quite some time. One other article that Jeremiah referenced there, we will link to in the show notes, "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe." That's the title of the article by Gerald Fleury. Richard, anything that you would send people to for a better understanding of the context of what's happening here?
Yeah, I'd encourage you to go and watch the latest Key of David from Mr. Fleury. Today's Key of David, Germany going underground. It's a really powerful Key of David. There's a lot in there that's pretty new. But this whole Nord Stream 2 pipeline and the relationship with Russia really does feature pretty heavily in that episode. It's all kind of predicated on the fact that there are business leaders within Germany that have been pushing this relationship with Russia, that Angela Merkel herself has said she's powerless to stop them, that this is kind of some concrete evidence of Germany's underground ambitions. And that they're really aiming to be a great power status. So I think what Jeremiah mentioned really does cover the Russia story most directly. But this Key of David is just a powerful one for exposing the way that Germany is working as well to really now have something that was underground coming to the fore and really taking over all of Europe.
All right. Well, thank you, Richard and Jeremiah. Now to a tragic story from about a week ago in America, a devastating series of tornadoes that ravaged six states. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it was actually shortly after we stopped recording the show last week that America was hit with some really catastrophic devastation. There was this cluster of 30 tornadoes that, like you said, ripped across six states over the course of Friday and Saturday. And so that's pretty unusual to have 30 tornadoes moving together all like that, broke many records. I think one of the tornadoes was moving at about 200 miles an hour, which makes it a lot of tornadoes. They only move about 3 to 4 miles an hour. If you hit 25, that's pretty exceptional. And so to be 200, that's like several orders of magnitudes faster than a tornado usually goes. It's not the fastest ever recorded, but probably the fastest recorded in about 95 to 100 years. Mm-hmm. I think there was one in 1925 that hit about 219 miles an hour. Also broke some records for deaths. I think the death count is up to about 84 people who've died from this cluster of 30 tornadoes, and about 200,000, almost a quarter of a million others who are out of power because of them. And so again, that 84, that makes this potentially the deadliest tornado in United States history, but at least the deadliest since 1890. So that's about 130 years, a little more than 130 years actually. So some pretty catastrophic devastation. Kentucky got hit the hardest, and the governor of Kentucky was he's obviously going to be dealing with a lot over this week. He has been dealing with a lot this week, and will be dealing with a lot in the weeks ahead, trying to rebuild his state. He made a pretty powerful comment, just kind of putting this in context of some of the other trials he and his state have been dealing with. Where he said, "I wish I understood why we've gotten hit with the pandemic, a historic ice storm, flooding, and now the worst tornado in our history, all in 19 months." Mm-hmm. And so when those are some things that aren't very related necessarily. The pandemic doesn't have really anything to do with the ice storm, which doesn't have anything really to do with the flooding, or which doesn't really have anything to do with the tornado in terms of like, just like your scientific explanation for why is this all coming at once. So you can see why he'd be slightly confused. But our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, had an article he put on as a Trumpet Brief this week. You can know why natural disasters, that really answers the questions that Governor Beshear is asking, pointing particularly to some prophecies in Matthew 24, where Jesus Christ himself is telling his disciples about the signs of his coming in the famous Olivet prophecy, and pointing in verse 14 to some of those signs being natural disasters like earthquakes. So it really just proves here that these natural disasters are things that God uses to get people's attention, things like famines, pestilence, earthquakes in diverse places. And then it says that all these are the beginning of sorrows. And then you put that together with some other verses, like the ones in Nahum 1, which says God has his way in the whirlwind, and Ezekiel 26 that talks about the blessings that come on a nation for obedience and the cursings that come on a nation for disobedience. You can definitely see that the reason why a state would be struck by an ice storm, a historic flood, the worst tornado in at least 130 years, and a COVID pandemic all at the same time shows that God really is trying to get the nation's attention.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. We will link to that Trumpet Brief from Gerald Fleury. You can know why natural disasters. We also have an article up on the website from Mihailo Zekic on this. Plague of tornadoes devastates America's heartland. You bring up a good point, just how the confluence of all of these disasters that are unrelated scientifically, it does cause a human mind to search for answers, to try to find some kind of unifying theory of why all of these things are hitting. And as you said, that really is exactly what God is trying to accomplish here. There's one quote in Mihailo's article that I think is very good. It's from the Why Natural Disasters booklet. Whenever God begins working with someone, he begins by humbling that individual. And it quotes Proverbs 15:33, the fear of the Lord is the instruction of wisdom, and before honor is humility. God wants to give each of us phenomenal honor, but the humility rooted in a deep respect for the Creator must come first. The curses God imposed upon Adam and his seed were intended to teach this lesson, and the suffering that saturates this present world cut off from God is intended to teach this lesson. It's very important to keep that spiritual perspective as we see this kind of crushing devastation, tragic devastation and loss that we're seeing in the states this past week. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was relentlessly attacked over a period of some years by people who really wanted to remove him from office. Well, now Mr. Netanyahu is on trial, and the veracity of the allegations against him are coming out. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, Carolyn Glick wrote a piece about this week entitled The Ugly Truth Comes Out about Netanyahu's trial. And it's kind of going through what's happened over the past 2 months, where you have all these state witnesses, the prosecution's witnesses, coming forward to try and back up the claims that we heard that Netanyahu is guilty of bribery, of fraud, breach of trust, accepting gifts from people that weren't necessarily his friends, gifts for favors and things like that. And so far, there's been 8 witnesses out of 333 witnesses that are meant to come forward, or at least that's the list that the prosecution has given. And as Carolyn Glick brings out, these are the 8 star witnesses that we've heard from so far. And yet, as we've seen, and as she records, each one of these witnesses is coming to the stand, and they're meant to be supporting the prosecution's case against Netanyahu. And yet, when all the facts come out, it's like they are actually helping out Netanyahu's case completely. This is what she says: but over the last 2 weeks, as one allegedly star witness after another took the stand, each rejected Mandelblit's contention. Mandelblit, of course, is the attorney general that indicted Netanyahu in the heat of those 4 elections, repeated elections from 2018 onwards. And then she writes, Netanyahu, in fact, received hostile coverage from the website in question. His political rivals received supportive coverage. And she goes through the different cases that Mandelblit, or different indictments that Mandelblit made against Netanyahu. And to show that these witnesses are not confirming them at all, basically they're saying the opposite. And what's really interesting is the degree to which the prosecution, let's say the police and the prosecution, actually got these witnesses to give statements that were really, they were very much pressured into giving statements. Their star witness was one of Netanyahu's very own assistants while he was in office. Nir Hefetz was his name. And he took the stand this past week. And Hefetz basically testified that he received ill treatment by police investigators at the direction of the state prosecutors. He was arrested in the middle of the night in a Hollywood-type scene, she writes, armed with the officers nearly breaking down his door. He was held in harsh conditions for 2 weeks. He was denied food, medicine, and sleep. He was placed in a flea-ridden cell. He was housed with violent convicted criminals and terrorists. Investigators threatened to destroy his family and coerced him into firing his attorney and hiring the one they chose for him. All of this was illegal. So you had this setup of the police and the state prosecutor that was led by Mandelblit, the attorney general, to try and really coerce witnesses to giving evidence against Netanyahu. This was years ago now, 3 years ago. And now when these very same witnesses take the stand, they're basically telling that they were coerced and not actually confirming any of what Mandelblit indicted Netanyahu for.
At the time that all of this was unfolding, all these accusations against Netanyahu, we were making really strong comparisons with the deep state in the United States attacking Donald Trump, and how there's a contingent within the Israeli government that was just very anti-Netanyahu, wanted him gone at all costs. What you're describing bears this out completely.
Yeah, it does, and it's kind of shocking, really, because you would expect to find some element of truth to all these claims, because we have quotes that came out two or three years ago during these election cycles from these very same witnesses. But what is revealed is that the quotes and the evidence that was brought forth was really cherry-picked by Mandelblit, by the press. They released these little bits of information that might have been true, but without context. And this came within those election cycles that were all about removing Bibi from power. And they eventually did. It took four elections, but eventually, through a lot of wrangling and a lot of people actually believed the indictments. The coalition of Likud and others broke apart. Many Likud Knesset members, that is Netanyahu's party, broke off to form their own parties to run against him because they felt like he was a sinking ship because of these indictments. And so it really did work. It worked at getting rid of Netanyahu for the time being. Of course, he's still in the Knesset and Likud. He's still the most powerful politician in Israel with the greatest single following of any man inside Israel's political scene. However, this is just showing that the ploy by Mandelblit and the leftists and the rogue Supreme Court we've written about, they came out to get Netanyahu, created a narrative, pushed the narrative to the media. The media sold the public on it, and it removed him from power. This was not an election steal. In some ways, we've talked about that, how there are similarities, but it was people voted based on lies that were fabricated by Israel's own politicians to get him out of power, and it was successful. And we'll see what it takes, where it goes from here, whether the public is going to actually understand what happened, or whether the press is going to bury this. And basically, you know, the press got their wish and the left got their wish. Netanyahu's out of power, and maybe the story won't be covered. But the Israel has one right-wing newspaper, Israel Hayom. It happens to be the largest daily newspaper. And so that's the hope, that this story actually receives some accurate coverage now.
Where would you send people for more information about this? We've written about this quite a bit.
Yeah, I wrote an article about it on January 1st this year. It's called, "Are the Unlawful Roots of the Netanyahu Witch Hunt About to Be Exposed?"
All right, thank you very much for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, Russia and China pulling ever closer together in response to pushback from other nations. The Israeli Prime Minister making his first visit to the United Arab Emirates. Skyrocketing inflation in America and Britain's government being battered by scandals. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We spoke in the first half about some extreme provocations from Russia. Well, China has also been riling up several other nations with its aggressive actions. These two nations are responding to the criticisms they're facing by drawing closer to one another. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the leaders of Russia and China, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, they held a major video conference on Wednesday and basically took the occasion to shore up ties between their two nations, but also to signal to the world that the relationship between Russia and China is now, in the words of Xi Jinping, better than an alliance. So he was acknowledging there that Russia and China don't have a formal alliance, but he said, quote, "In its closeness and effectiveness, this relationship even exceeds an alliance." Then a little later he said, "China and Russia firmly support each other on issues concerning each other's core interests and safeguarding the dignity of each country." During this meeting, they went through their usual custom of, you know, calling each other dear friend and old friend, and just stressing the role that their personal relationship plays in the broader Russia-China dynamic. And then there was a statement issued by Putin that said, "A new model of cooperation has been formed between our countries, one based on foundations like non-interference in domestic affairs and respect for each other's interests. So he's really echoing Xi Jinping there and just emphasizing that this is a new model, a new path that they're charting, and that they believe, or at least want the world to believe, that it's even better than an alliance. And the public statements published after the meeting didn't divulge many details, but we do know that especially since 2014, when the West began trying to isolate Russia over its annexation of some Ukrainian territory, that China and Russia have grown tremendously close. And, you know, it's happened with everything from trade and geopolitics to security and military cooperation. So as tension between Russia and the West keeps on rising, and as tension between China and the West keeps on rising, we can expect Putin and Xi to keep on looking to each other for support more and more. This was actually the 37th meeting that Putin and Xi have had since 2013. And it really is a unique and a formidable bond that the two sides are building. And it's one that is helping them both to just better expand their own power and influence.
All of these nations that are, they're threatening to boycott the Olympics. This is happening among several nations that are really upset with China and several of the moves that it's taking for Putin to be basically the first world leader to step up and say, I will be there, is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, that was one thing that came up during this meeting. Putin did, basically, he became the first world leader to RSVP to the Olympic Games. They're going to be in Beijing in February. And you know, a lot of countries have decided to boycott those, at least in a diplomatic way. The Biden administration, for example, said America will not be sending a delegation to the Games. So American athletes are still competing, but the vice president and the first lady and their entourage, who normally attend at least the opening and closing ceremonies, will not be going. So it's actually kind of a shamefully weak boycott against China, but it's still an embarrassment for the Chinese. And now we have Australia, Canada, and the UK that are all following America's lead. There are some individual European politicians that are boycotting it as well. But the fact that Putin came out and said, I will be there, you know, that was he was really throwing kind of a PR lifeline to China, because China wants to use the games to showcase its global stature and power. It would really be a big blow to China if all it did was highlight, you know, China's souring relationship with the rest of the world. So I do think that was a big PR lifeline that Putin threw to the Chinese.
So talk to us about the biblical prophecy. We've brought this up many times as we've seen this relationship developing. Historically, it's extraordinary to see this kind of partnership developing between these two Asian giants, but the Bible said this is what would happen.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and that's really why we at the Trumpet watch the strengthening Russia-China ties so closely, because Bible prophecy talks about a multinational Asian power bloc that will form in the modern era. The book of Revelation calls it the kings of the East. If you look in the book of Ezekiel, it even gives some names that specifically refer to Russia and China, showing that they'll be really the main powers in that kings of the East grouping. And the scriptures show that it will play a major role in the final world war. So those are just deeply important prophecies. And as you said, Russia and China have not always been close. Just in the 60s, they were at each other's throats with a border war and threats of nuclear war, very serious tensions. But even at that time, the Trumpet's predecessor, the Plain Truth magazine, continued to say that Russia and China would soon ally. And now here we are a few decades on from there, and they're remarkably close. They're even telling the world now that their relationship is better than an alliance. So we can really see these prophecies are in the process of being fulfilled.
Just a remarkable instance of how reliable Bible prophecy is. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. We will link to that trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China. And as we've been tracking, Iran's rise, combined with America's withdrawal from the Middle East, is forcing Israel and other nations in the region to draw together as well. For this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, there was another story about this week. It appeared in the Wall Street Journal on December 13th, entitled Fear of Iran Shrinking U.S. Role in Middle East Push Rivals Together. And it basically starts off detailing this groundbreaking visit from Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett to the United Arab Emirates for the first time to meet with the Crown Prince there, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed. And he went there again on Monday, discussed business deals that Israel is making with the Emiratis. I think Israel has just this past year, in the past 10 months, trade has increased tenfold between the two countries. This is, of course, happening in the wake of the Abraham Accords that were brokered by President Trump between Israel and the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, as well. And what we're seeing now are the fruits of that. And I think what's interesting about this development is that you do see, again, these really strong, or let's say these alliances that are firming up in the wake of the two big major issues in the Middle East. One is Iran and its quest for a nuclear weapon, which is not slowing. And the other is what the United States is doing. What is the United States doing to try and to curtail Iran's enrichment of uranium? It looks like absolutely nothing. And so you've got the Israelis, the Emiratis, the Saudis. They are pulling together, and more news stories are coming out about this.
Quite a fascinating development, considering that it was Donald Trump who got the Abraham Accords going and was encouraging these Middle Eastern nations to build ties with Israel. When Joe Biden came to power, it looked like he had no interest in carrying these on, but it's actually his administration's support for Iran, or certainly a conciliatory position toward Iran, that is causing this to move forward even faster.
Yeah, even faster is correct. I mean, I think inside this article, there's a quote from Joshua Tettelbaum. I'll just quote him. He's from Bar-Ilan University here in Israel. He said this: "All the players, Israel, the UAE, everyone is jockeying for position. There is a new administration talking about the United States with a policy we're still guessing over, and Iran is on the threshold of getting a nuclear weapon. It's forcing everyone to renew relationships." And so, yeah, what started as President Trump's push to even extricate the United States from the region and favored a joint security pact between Israel and the Saudis and the Emiratis and such, now the hasty removal of U.S. forces combined with the supporting of the arch enemy of these states, Iran, is bringing them even closer together. And the UAE is hoping that a partnership with Israel does actually increase their own ability to defend themselves. Israel, of course, is the most advanced military in the region, and you know the UAE wants some of that weaponry. Now, what's really, I think, prophetically important about this is that the Bible actually describes that there would be a close relationship between the little nation of Israel, biblical Judah, and the Gulf states, and then others as well. This is found in Psalm 83. This is a close relationship that is going to precipitate a gigantic betrayal against Israel. And this is why we're watching this story. It isn't the fact that they're combining and we're thinking that this is the dawn of a new peace between Israel and the Arabs. It's actually preparing the way for a very important biblical prophecy, and one that I think many Israelis might actually have in the back of their mind, thinking, well, does the UAE actually like us? Do the Saudis actually like us? Or is this basically they're hedging their bets and saying, well, let's side with Israel for now, just in case we need to attack Iran, and this is going to benefit us? Well, what happens if Iran is taken out of the way, like biblical prophecy says is going to take place? What happens to the relationship between Israel and the UAE? What happens to this security pact? What happens to shared intelligence? What happens if they actually work together militarily? That actually opens up Israel to a gigantic danger that the UAE will be very aware of their military technology and even have an inside view and it could use that to attack the state of Israel. Now, Mr. Flurry talks about the dangers of the peace deals with these specific Arab states in an article entitled "Peace with the Arabs, Can It Happen?" And it goes through the prophetic details that I think people should be aware of as they see Israel's prime minister go to Abu Dhabi.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that, Brent. We will link to that article in the show notes. Despite assurances from the Biden administration to the contrary, inflation in the United States continues to rise. For this story, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, here's a pretty shocking statistic. Half of America's population has never experienced inflation this high. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reported on December 10th that the Consumer Price Index rose 6.8% in the 12-month period ending November 30th. And so now that's basically just a fancy way saying that the inflation's 6.8% over the past year. And so that 6.8%, the last time inflation was that high was in May 1982, which basically means that anyone under age 40, which is about half of the people in the nation, have never actually seen 6.8% inflation. And depending on what you're buying, it could be worse than that. They break it down that like 6.8% is the average overall. Food prices are up about 6.1%. Gasoline prices, this probably won't be shocking to anyone who's filled up recently, but still notable to see on paper, is 58.1% inflation over the past year. Shelter, like your mortgage or your rent payment, that's about 3.8%. Used cars, 31%, and new cars, 11%. So these are some pretty shocking numbers that, depending on the economist you ask, could even be well underestimated. The United States Bureau of Labor Statistics has changed the algorithms they use to calculate inflation like 30 times in 30 years or something crazy like that. And so according to John Williams, who runs a site called shadowstats.com, he said if they use the same algorithms and equations they used to calculate inflation when Jimmy Carter was president, the number you'd get would be 15%. And so you look back at like it's easy to look back at like the Carter years and being, oh well, they had double digit inflation back then. You're like, well, if they calculated it the same way, we'd have double digit inflation right now. And so definitely 1982, that's when Reagan was elected. So this is the worst since the Carter years for anyone old enough to remember that.
So this is all happening against the backdrop of Joe Biden trying to pass the Build Back Better bill that is, $3 trillion invested into infrastructure. He says it's not going to cost a penny. The CBO says, no, it's actually going to increase the national debt $3 trillion. And there's just a lot of deceit on the part of this administration, even as they try to spin these numbers and to convince the American people who are out there buying groceries and filling their gas tank that this is actually not that bad, that they don't have to worry about it. It's exposing just how deceitful and how unreliable and really how sinister this administration is.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, just at like an elementary level, if you look at what causes inflation, it's like, all right, well, if you print money that you didn't earn, or you borrow money that you didn't earn, and you put that into circulation, you haven't added any value to your economy. Your economy is still worth the same. But you're dividing the share of the economy into more and more dollars. And so each dollar is worth less. And so many economists have very logically and commonsensically pointed out that, like, if you print or borrow $3 trillion for this infrastructure bill, that's going to make inflation worse. The Biden administration has countered that, no, actually, that's going to make inflation better because it's going to fix our airports and fix our roads and fix our bridges, and that's going to solve all the supply chain problems in America. Even though some of our roads and some of our bridges and some of our airports have been old for a long time, and we didn't have supply chain problems just a year ago, that's a function of a lot of the COVID lockdowns and the ripple effects from that. And so it's not going to solve our inflation problems, and it is going to make inflation worse. We're seeing the numbers come out now as that, like, we keep breaking record after record after record, month after month, and a lot of people are not, they're not buying the lies that Joe Biden's telling them anymore. Maybe initially they did, but according to the latest opinion polls, like something like, I think it was 62% of Americans disagree with how the Biden administration's tackling inflation. That's like basically all Republicans and even about half the Democrats don't like how the Biden administration's tackling inflation, which is bad news for him because he's those same polls show that most Americans also don't like how he's tackling crime and gun violence and relations with Russia and other things. And so his approval ratings are at, well, I say historic lows. He's only been president for a year, but his approval ratings are going down. And Donald Trump's really capitalized on that, saying he had a couple powerful quotes saying once that inflation is going to ravage this country unless someone steps in to do something about it, and said that it will be a big factor in determining if he comes back to the White House. And so it seems like as this inflation gets worse and worse, many Americans are starting to think that maybe we do need Trump back in the White House so I can afford groceries again.
Yeah, you know, we've just sent the new print edition of The Trumpet off to the printer, and Gerald Flory has his From the Editor piece is called Barack Obama Exposed, and he makes the point that he feels confident that a lot of the corruption that Barack Obama was involved in is actually coming out, that he feels like the tide is turning and you're seeing a certain, he specifically is talking about revelations of corruption that were exposed by John Ratcliffe and documents that he provided to John Durham and so on. But in some ways, the public opinion that is turning against the Biden administration and just the lunacy of some of the lies that they're telling, and even the press, the way that the press is covering this, the fact that they are absolutely in bed with this administration is being exposed in a phenomenal way. All of this is happening in some pretty stunning ways. It's a pretty stunning development in the United States, especially when you view it in light of, as you said, that prophecy of this transformation, this changeover that is going to happen in the presidential office. So we will stay tuned to see how this unfolds. You can definitely see the irritation and the anger of the American people could certainly play a huge factor in that when you see it playing out in these financial and economic arenas. We appreciate that very much. We do have an article up on the website, Inflation Hits Highest Level in 39 Years, from Andrew. So thank you, Andrew. While America's presidential administration is getting some black eyes in public opinion, the same is happening to the Prime Minister's office in Britain. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, it's really been a pretty disastrous and kind of ridiculous few weeks for Britain. Today, the Conservative Party suffered a humiliating defeat in a by-election, an election where somebody, the previous MP from that region, had been forced to step down. The Conservative Party have held that particular seat since 1830, and they lost it. It's one of the biggest ever swings in a by-election in British history, and it shows a deep dissatisfaction with Britain's leadership right now. And it's not too surprising. We've had a leadership that has introduced vaccine passports just this week for big events, something that just about everybody at the top of this government repeatedly promised that they would never do. It's also been, over the last couple of weeks, I think we're up to about 8 parties now, where this government... Normally, I would have no problem with the government holding parties or some of these drink get-togethers or things like that. But this is a government that made it illegal for you to get together in your home with one other person. And while the government was doing that, they were hosting parties at government offices. Boris Johnson himself was, he made it illegal for 2 people to get together. He got together with 2 other people and hosted a quiz show. during May. At one point in May, big first lockdown, he gave a press conference, you know, telling everybody, fear, 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 stay at home, do what you're told, etc. And then immediately after the press conference, went to a wine and pizza party. It is hypocrisy on a level that I don't think I've personally witnessed before. It's just staggering. So, you know, that's feeding into the dissatisfaction. And then at the same time, there's just this massive push for more fear. You know, I think all of this hypocrisy means that people aren't listening to the government as much as they were. Mm-hmm. Sadly, there are still a lot of people that are listening to the government, but there's more and more, you know, disobeying mask mandates, ignoring government guidance and rules. And the government is upset by this, so they've been really piling on the fear. And you've seen this with the Omicron variant, where they managed to find one person now in all of the world that has died with Omicron, so they're really pushing that. South Africa published some good news showing that Omicron wasn't that bad, and immediately the government called a press conference so that they could tell everybody, no, keep panicking, do not be comforted by this good news. So it's really been a shameful week in British politics.
It is the same story playing out in America and Britain with this massive erosion in trust by the public of their governments. You see the governments just behaving in such appalling ways, the public's ability to trust what the government is doing is absolutely ravaged. And that has all kinds of ripple effects, dramatic effects through these modern Israelitish nations.
It does. And you know, all of this is just matching exactly what the Bible says would happen for these Israelite countries. I think we do tend to focus maybe on some of the more, say, hard news events in terms of fulfilled prophecy, where we'll talk on this show about, well, you know, the Bible says that you'd have Iran be the king of the south and they'd have control of this country. And we made this forecast and this has happened exactly the way that the Bible said. But you look at these social events and you see the same kind of proof for Bible prophecy there as well, where there are so many specific prophecies about what society would look like at this end time. Isaiah 3 is full of your prophecies about leadership conditions, about lack of good leadership. There's all kinds of prophecies about hypocrisy and that would permeate a leadership. The book of Amos is full of prophecies about corrupt leadership that are partying and drinking and carrying on with excess at the same time that they rob other people's livelihoods, which is exactly what you see going on. So, you know, this kind of leadership, it is a curse from God. It is prophesied. And we do have an article in the January Trumpet print edition, Why Your World is Changing So Suddenly, by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, where he does talk about this and talks about how we need to recognize that these kind of things too are a curse from God. This is something that can point us to God and to the Bible as well, as kind of frustrating and aggravating to see all this hypocrisy can be.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, that if you're viewing all of this from a spiritual standpoint, then it all makes sense. You see the direction that so many of these trends are taking and the way that they do reinforce prophecies of the Bible. These curses that the modern nations of Israel are experiencing really do show God's hand in events that are taking place in this world. I am very excited about the next print edition of The Trumpet. This is the February 2022 edition of The Trumpet. The entire issue is devoted to this what is one of the most dramatic stories taking place in the world today, the fall of the English-speaking people. We have feature articles about the United States from our editor-in-chief, about Britain from Richard Palmer. We have an article about Canada from Abe Blondeau, an article about Australia from trumpet writer Callum Wood, and an article about New Zealand from one of our Watch Jerusalem contributors, Chris Eames, who is a native New Zealander. And it's just a phenomenal story. And then putting that in the context of the times of the Gentiles and some of the most dramatic stories of the or prophecies of the Bible, it brings that landmark book that Herbert W. Armstrong wrote years, decades ago, right up to date, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. When you see these events taking place, it really should arrest your attention and point you back to some of these pillar prophecies that Mr. Armstrong was talking about years ago and that we've been hammering about on for some decades now. So look for that. That'll be up at thetrumpet.com next week, and it should be in mailboxes here in just a few weeks. So we really appreciate you bringing that to us, Richard. That will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Chuck Swindoll. We are all faced with a series of great opportunities, brilliantly disguised as impossible situations. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.